This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. Do you have heroes and heroines? What do they mean to you? What price a piece of their life? In this programme, we look at some of those many of us look up to through things connected to them. We have an explorer, and possibly a comment on his drinking habits, a physicist and his dodgy investments, the secret of and postcard from an escapologist, and a truly heroic price off the chopping block. Australia nearly took top honours in the International Olympics of Museum Achievements. In this programme, we found out how a government decision robbed an Australian museum of that global gold medal. Or was it a blessing? And we go in search of gold, or at least a treasure hunt of another kind. My pocket dictionary, POD for short, says a hero is demigod, man of superhuman qualities, man admired for great deeds and noble qualities, etc., etc. Presumably also for a heroine, who's a female hero. It's a demigoddess, woman of superhuman qualities, etc. Do you have someone in mind whom you admire greatly? Would you pay a premium to own a part of his or her life? What do objects tell us about people and our heroes? In a previous programme, that was podcast number 18 on 2RPH website, which is 2rph.org.au, and press buttons Listen, Podcasts and Antiques Radio Show, we discussed a stuffed penguin from the Antarctic and the unsuccessful attempt by Robert Falcon Scott in 1913 to be the first to the South Pole. He's certainly an iconic figure and a hero to many. What price a piece of his life? And what bit of his life? Let's imagine a small conical glass jug with a silver collar and flat hinged lid for whiskey and water. Small silver labels on chains around the neck. What would they cost? Somewhere around, I guess, $200 each? Say, $600 for three? Well, here's a piece from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 21st of March, written by Ian McKay. Scott's Whiskey. Among the Antarctic lots in the travel and exploration sale at Bonhams on February the 26th, the outstanding result was a bid of £22,000, that's altogether about $50,000 Australian, 10 times the high estimate on a group of three glass jugs with silver lids, rims, and in two cases, hanging labels marked whiskey. These fittings bore a London hallmark for 1908, and the 10-centimetre, 4-inch-high jugs, their lids bearing the monograms RFS, are thought likely to have been a wedding gift to Robert Falcon Scott. In that year, he married Kathleen Bruce in the Chapel Royal at Hampton Court. The jugs were last seen at auction in 1985 as part of a consignment of silver items engraved for Scott, that was sent for auction at Hatton Garden's auctions by his son, Sir Peter Scott. A copy of that earlier sale catalogue and related documentation were part of the lot. And thank you, Ian McKay, writing in the Antique Trade Gazette of the 21st of March. And it looks like Robert Falcon Scott might have liked the odd whiskey. Certainly an expensive memento. But was Scott one of your heroes? I have a hero. Mine is Sir Isaac Newton, 1642 to 1727. Taken from the internet, Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics describes him as being generally regarded as the most original and influential theorist in the history of science. In 1661, he went to Trinity College, Cambridge, and in 1667 became both a fellow of the college and a member of the Royal Society. In 1668, at the age of only 26, he invented a reflective telescope. In 1687, he published his masterpiece, written in Latin, Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica. But what sets him apart, at least for me, from other geniuses or genii, was that he was no ivory tower scholar. He was a Member of Parliament from 1689 to 1690 and again 1701 to 1702. In 1699 he became Master of the Mint, as coin collectors, that's numismatists, will know. This piece from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 20th of June, by, again, Ian MacKay, tells us that despite Newton's towering genius, worldliness and social pragmatism, he had human failings. Newton gets into bubble trouble. Document signed by the great scientist reveals an investment skill not to the same standard. Dated July the 13th, a document of 1720 that for the rest of his life Sir Isaac Newton bitterly regretted signing was sold in a Connecticut auction of May the 6th for $85,000. The top lot in the University Archives sale was a costly reminder of the South Sea bubble disaster and the speculative mania that effectively ruined so many British investors in that year. Founded in 1711 to trade with Spanish America, the grandly titled Company of Merchants of Great Britain Trading to the South Seas and Other Parts of America and for Encouraging Fishery had noble pretensions, but its main business at the time was slave trading. It is recorded that Newton, when once asked his opinion of the prospect of South Sea stock, replied that he could calculate the motions of the heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people. Newton had nevertheless signed up for the great enterprise, but at one stage liquidated his original investment of £7,000 to reap a solid profit of 100%. He had been well advised, for the stock price decreased shortly thereafter. But then the company rallied and speculation again became rampant, and many investors, Newton among them, were lured back into the market. Stock prices at first soared, but by September 1720, the market had collapsed and shares dragged down government stocks with them. Newton lost $20,000. Thank you, Ian MacKay, again. An expensive mistake for Newton and a very expensive document for the buyer. But we're all human, make mistakes, and have our passions as well as our heroes. And moving to a different sort of genius and a different realm of heroics, we go to the Antique Trade Gazette of the 20th of June. Way to unlock Houdini secrets. Dating from circa 1908, a notebook of the secrets from Harry Houdini's collection was one of the more successful lots in a very successful magic auction held by Potter & Potter, one that ended on the 2nd of May with 98% of lots sold and a total of around $500,000. That notebook was filled with notes, diagrams and descriptions of magic tricks and apparatus in two different hands. It sold well at $9,000, but through bearing a later 1923 signature in Houdini's hand, the notebook itself was not actually his work, said the sale room. And there was also another Houdini lot in that Chicago sale, and which is pictured in the Antique Trade Gazette, and it's a postcard. It's a shackled Harry Houdini is seen as the famous jailbreaker on a New Year postcard bearing English and German text that he sent in 1907 to a Russian hotel operator in Odessa. It was sold by Potter & Potter for $3,400. And again, the name attracts the attention and is reflected in the price. And there's no escaping that if you want a piece of Houdini's life. But let's change the tune and move to inventive genius. We hear of more heroics, and this comes from the 13th of June and the Antique Trade Gazette on page 32. Rare phonograph ready to play. The Parisian clockmaker Henri Luret, 1848 to 1938, entered the market for talking machines in an unconventional fashion. His first patented device of 1893 was a talking doll. The celluloid cylinders he created for the toy proved more robust than others on the market and could be easily duplicated by the moulding process. By the late 1890s, he was recording and manufacturing several sizes of musical cylinders, some 1,400 titles in all, to be played on a range of patented clockwork phonographs he called Lioregraphs. Perhaps the most ambitious of these was Le Lioré No. 3, a nickel-plated brass phonograph on a wooden tripod that was driven by weights. A contemporary engraving showing Lioré demonstrating its merits to an audience at the Trocadero Auditorium circa 1898 is perhaps better known than the instrument itself. Relatively few have survived. The example offered for sale at technology specialists auction team Brecker in Cologne on May the 16th came with its original reproducer and horn plus three celluloid cylinders that confirmed it was in playing condition. Estimated at €7,000 to €9,000, it sold to a phone bidder at €20,000, which in Australian dollars, including buyer's premium, is somewhere in the vicinity of $40,000. Let's now bring the axe down on heroics, and this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 27th of June. Tomahawk tempts a buyer at $540,000, that's US. The highlight of Morphy's auction's sale of historical militaria from the independent struggle and wars of 1812 era on May the 27th was a rare and extensively provenanced presentation pipe tomahawk. Sold for $540,000 to an American buyer against an estimate of $300,000 to $500,000, it was the star turn in the Founders and Patriot sales, which made up the first of 3 days of auctions in Denver, Pennsylvania. The 21-inch, 53-centimetre, long silver-mounted tomahawk was a maple wood haft decorated with two sections of Shawnee porcupine quillwork. The blade is signed R. Butler, and the silver-end cap to the haft is inscribed Lieutenant McClellan. As discussed in the preview in ATG's number 2443, the tomahawk was made by Richard Butler, an armourer for Fort Pitt, Pennsylvania, from 1765 to 77, who was later commissioned as a captain in the Pennsylvania militia and was a trusted confidant of the Shawnee and Delaware Indians. McClellan served with the Pennsylvania Riflemen and carried the weapon with him during the American War of Independence. He died en route to the Quebec, and the tomahawk was given to his brother, Daniel, who continued to Quebec and took part in the battle where he was taken prisoner by the British. A British officer plundered the tomahawk along with the rest of his valuable possessions, and the war trophy was taken back to England. In a catalogue of the rarities to be seen at Don Soltero's coffee house in Chelsea, printed in 1785 in London, number 148 is listed as an Indian tomahawk taken in the field of battle before Quebec. It was purchased by George Greville, 1746-1816, Earl of Warwick, for his arms collection at Warwick Castle. It remained there until it was loaned to the Tower of London. In 1996, the Earl offered some of the collection at auction, and the tomahawk was sold at Christie's. Since then, it has featured in several private collections, has been exhibited, and included in a number of reference works. And in Australian dollars, the price of the tomahawk altogether is something in the vicinity of $1 million. And that's quite a chop. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. We now leave heroes behind and move on to other things. Australia does not very often get a tilt at top billing and the gold medal in the international arena of world museums. The Antiques Radio Show, podcast number 6, and if you want to hear that, go to the website and click Listen, Podcasts and Antiques Radio Show, related a story written by Tim Stone in the Art newspaper of July-August 2018. The Pride and Place would be taken down under. This opportunity has now been lost, and the gold medal has gone elsewhere. The Art newspaper's headline read, $890 million Sydney Museum move could be the most expensive gallery relocation in history. That figure, of course, is US dollars, which corresponds to about 1.2 billion Australian dollars. How did Australia lose Pride of Place? Or is it, or was it, a dubious honour? We read from the Sun Herald newspaper of the 5th of July. And this is a comment by Leo Schofield that appears on page 5. Make no mistake, this is a victory for cultural life. The retention of the powerhouse in Ultimo is a landmark moment in the cultural history of New South Wales. It is an occasion not for triumphalism, but quiet celebration that sanity and vision won out over political opportunism. Equally welcome is the decision to give the people of Western Sydney a cultural institution of their own, one that reflects their remarkable history, their interests, and their ambitions. For those of us who opposed the move or relocation, it was never a question of one or the other. Museums are about collections, and in the powerhouse's astonishing, eclectic holdings, there are enough objects to fill two museums and specialist satellite institutions. Long before the powerhouse sprang into being, I was taken to a storage facility in Alexandria, in vast sheds once used to hold bales of wool, spaces whose lanolin-soaked floors were an invitation to destruction by fire, were hundreds of wooden crates, their contents unclassified. Some had information stenciled on the side, messages such as 10 assorted Oriental objects, one of which turned out to be a Han period bronze bell of incredible rarity, plunder from the Boxer Rebellion. Scattered on the floor were original drawings by Lucien Henry, a series of quirky designs for furniture, buildings and decorative schemes incorporating images of Australian flora. In the mid-1980s, a movement emerged to rehabilitate these and hundreds of other treasures, to find a home for them and to exhibit for the first time in almost a century. First came a call to the RAN government to relocate the old Museum of Applied Arts and Sciences across the road in Harris Street, Ultimo. A proposal to use the Treasury Building, part of the historic Macquarie Street precinct, was stymied by the then all-powerful head of the Premier's department, Gary Gleeson. The Treasury became the Intercontinental Hotel. As a consolation prize, the government offered the powerhouse site. With great spaces, ceilings so high one could suspend aircraft from them, this repurposed industrial building turned out to be an inspired choice. In Stage 1, an adjacent tram shed was made over while work proceeded on the main building. At the front, a preview exhibition comprised a sample of the museum's collection, including the sublime Boulton and Watt steam engine. Behind, a state-of-the-art storage and restoration facility was installed. Excitement about the project was universal. When the main museum was opened in 1988, there followed a rush of donations, funded acquisitions, and awe-struck visitors. Perhaps it was inevitable that as those cultural temperature of Sydney rose, enthusiasm for the powerhouse waned. Some unfortunate appointments were made, and a little of the glow of the early days faded. But when it was threatened with obliteration, Sydneysiders rose in defence, not only of a building, but an institution that had served to entertain, instruct, and surprise successive generations. So let's have no recriminations, just relief and alleluias that the right decision has been made. Now is the time for us to ensure this 140-year-old institution makes a magnificent comeback. I have loved it for nigh on 80 years. All that is needed now is more love. Thank you, Leo Schofield, who, the note on the bottom of the article says, is a former trustee of the Powerhouse Museum. Well, we know now where that jewel box, which is the Powerhouse Museum, is going to be located. But let's move to a different sort of treasure, the location of which was very secret and not discovered until very recently. Have you read that 19th century novel Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, written in 1883? Did it make you wonder why pirates or anyone would bury treasure and on an island? Well, here's a real 21st century treasure story, and it comes from Sarah Casconi at news.artnet.com and was sourced on the 8th of June. And it reads, a decade ago, a New Mexico art and antiquities dealer buried $2 million worth of jewels, gold, and artifacts in the wilderness of the Rocky Mountains and invited would-be treasure hunters to try and claim it. Now, an unnamed explorer has finally solved the riddle, finding the treasure that eluded hundreds of thousands of hunters before him, including at least five who died in the attempt. Forrest Fenn, the eccentric millionaire and amateur archaeologist who buried the loot, announced the news on his website on Sunday. It was under a canopy of stars in the lush forested vegetation of the Rocky Mountains and had not moved from the spot where I hid it more than 10 years ago, he wrote. So the search is over. New Mexico authorities had urged people to give up the hunt after Paris Wallace, a Colorado pastor, died in pursuit of treasure in 2017, but Fenn refused to call off the contest. The art dealer, now 89, planted clues to the treasure's location in his memoir, The Thrill of the Chase, self-published in 2010 with a 24-line poem inviting adventure seekers to search for the 13th century Romanesque bronze chest and its valuable contents. He estimated that some 300,000 people have taken up the challenge over the years, some quitting their jobs in order to dedicate themselves to the task. I feel halfway kind of glad, halfway kind of sad, because the chase is over, Fenn told the Santa Fe New Mexican. The guy who found it does not want his name mentioned. He's from back east. The art dealer said the anonymous treasure hunter had sent him a photograph revealing the hidden trove, said to contain gold dust, coins and nuggets, as well as carved Chinese jade, gold pre-Columbian animal statues, animal jewellery gemstones and other valuable artifacts had been uncovered at long last. Already there's controversy over the discovery, however. Barbara Anderson, a Chicago real estate attorney, is filing a lawsuit against the person who found the chest. She claims she solved the puzzle first, but that a current winner cheated and beat her to the physical location. He stole my solve. He followed and cheated me to get the chest, Anderson told the New Mexican. Fenn was inspired to create the treasure hunt to offer people who had lost their jobs during the recession some hope, and also to encourage people to explore the wilderness and seek old-fashioned adventures. But he didn't necessarily expect anyone to succeed in the task. I'm actually a bit shocked because I hid it in a pretty good place and lots of people over the years couldn't find it, he told ABC affiliate Denver 7. But this man followed the clues in my poem, and they took him right to the treasure, and that's what it's all about. And thank you for that, Sarah Casconi. I rather love that story, a bit of boyhood adventure. And I wonder if Robert Louis Stevenson wouldn't have appreciated it as well. And let's finish with someone who was a history changer, if not a hero. Henry VIII, of six-wife fame, amongst other numerous achievements. Here's a reading from a flyer of a new book which uncovers aspects of his life and times. A marvel to behold, gold and silver at the court of Henry VIII, written by Timothy Schroeder. By the time of his death, Henry VIII had amassed one of the most spectacular collections of gold and silver of any British monarch, but nearly all of these holdings were destroyed over the following century, and no more than a handful have survived to modern times. This book makes use of the wealth of surviving documentation to explore this lost collection and the light it sheds on the monarchy. Starting with an assessment of the young king's inheritance from his father, the book considers the role of plate at state banquets, in great church services, and in the regular exchange of gifts between courtiers and ambassadors. The role of plate and jewels as a potent symbol of power, how the king used confiscation as an instrument of humiliation of those who fell from grace, including Cardinal Wolsey and Catherine of Aragon, and how Henry's avaricious seizure of church plate towards the end of his life throws light on his changing character. While the focus is on plate and goldsmith's work, the context ranges from court ceremonial to rivalry between princes, the role of the church, the vulnerability of persons and institutions with covetable assets, and relations between the king and his own family. And the book is written by Timothy Schroeder, who was curator of decorative arts at the Los Angeles County Museum and a consultant curator at the Victoria and Albert Museum. Current or recent roles include Prime Warden of the Goldsmiths Company, President of the Silver Society, and a trustee of the Wallace Collection. And the book, it costs £45, has 124 colour illustrations in its 400 pages, and is published by Boydell and Brewer. And if you want to check that out, go to www.boydellandbrewer.com. And don't forget that you can hear all previous Antiques Radio Show programs, because the podcasts can be found on the 2RPH website, that's 2rph.org.au, and by clicking Listen, Podcasts and Antiques Radio Show. That's all you have to do, and Bob's your uncle. Do you know the origins of the expression, Bob's your uncle? Well, it's not all that dissimilar in meaning to she's apples. And that brings us back to Isaac Newton, my hero, who's said to have discovered gravity thanks to sitting under an apple tree and having an apple land on his head. Thank you for listening. And I hope you have a happy hero-worshipping and treasure-hunting time ahead of you. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.